Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. What if I told you that a speck of bone dust, something no bigger than a single grain of sand, could reveal the darkest family secrets of a man who died over 100,000 years ago?
It is wild to think about.
Right. Because time is just a crazy concept. If you go back a few generations in your own family, the faces start to blur. Go back a few centuries, and entire civilizations just feel like abstract concepts.
Yeah, totally.
But today, we're going to look right into the exact genetic blueprint of an ancient human. We're so thrilled you're here with us on this deep dive, especially because we know you're the kind of person who, you know, never stops asking questions about how we got here.
Absolutely.
So how could this change our whole understanding of human evolution and what really happens when you pull pure DNA from a speck of cave dust?
Well, you get a high-definition portrait that tells us how he lived, who his ancestors loved, and ultimately why his people vanished.
Which brings us to our mission today. Today, we celebrate the work of Diendo Masilani and a massive international team of researchers who have advanced our understanding of ancient hominins with a truly groundbreaking open access research article.
Yeah, it's published in the journal PNAS on March 23, 2026.
Right, and it's titled, A High-Coverage Neanderthal Genome from the Altai Mountains Reveals Population Structure Among Neanderthals.
It is just a phenomenal piece of scientific literature. I mean, we're talking about reading the complete DNA of a male Neanderthal who died before the last ice age even reached its peak.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we can get into the actual drama of his life, we have to talk about the sheer mind-bending reality of how he even got his DNA.
Yeah, the core methodology here is wild.
It really is. So we are discussing a specimen known to researchers as Denisova 17, or just D17.
Right.
And when people hear the word specimen, I think you usually picture a perfectly preserved skull sitting on a velvet pillow in a museum, right?
Oh yeah, not at all. D17 was found back in 2011 in layer 12 of the East Chamber of Denisova Cave. That's in the Altai Mountains of Siberia.
Okay.
And physically, it was a tiny, completely unrecognizable fragment of bone. You really wouldn't be able to tell it apart from a piece of gravel or like a splinter of animal bone just by looking at it.
Wait, so if this bone fragment just looked like a piece of gravel, why didn't the archaeologists just throw it out with the dirt? How did it even make it to a lab?
Well, that comes down to a screening technique called paleoproteomics, specifically a method they use called ZoomS.
Okay, stop right there. Paleoproteomics. ZoomS. Translate that for me.
Sure enough, yeah. Think of ZoomS as a like a molecular barcode scanner for ancient bone dust.
A barcode scanner, okay.
Yeah, it stands for zooarchaeology by mass spectrometry. Basically, the researchers take these anonymous little splinters of bone and they analyze the collagen proteins inside them.
Ah, because collagen differs by species.
Yeah. Exactly. Hmm. Different animal families, you know, bears, hyenas, humans, they all have slightly different weights and shapes to their collagen molecules.
Oh.
So they put the sample through a mass spectrometer, which weighs the molecules.
Oh, wow.
And when they scanned this specific splinter, the molecular barcode flagged it as hominin. It belonged to the human family tree. That was the crucial first clue.
That is amazing. And the preservation of this tiny bone is just unbelievable once they actually got into it. The researchers used a specialized bentel drill to extract powder from it.
Yep.
And they only took 14.1 milligrams. I mean, for context, a standard grain of sand weighs about a milligram. So we are talking about a literal pinch of dust here.
Barely anything.
But inside that pinch of dust, they found 1.6 billion DNA molecules per milligram.
Which is an absolute gold mine for ancient DNA. I mean, usually DNA from 100,000 years ago is heavily degraded. It breaks down into these tiny short fragments, and the chemical letters themselves degrade because of heat and moisture over all those millennia.
Right, it just rots away.
Exactly. But because of the cold, stable, almost freezer-like environment of that Siberian cave, this sample was incredibly well preserved. So it allowed a team to generate what we call a high-quality, roughly 37-fold coverage genome. And they didn't even have to destroy the entire sample to do it.
Okay, I want to make sure I really understand that 37-fold coverage part, because that seems central to why this paper is such a big deal.
Yes, yeah.
The way I picture it, it's like having 37 incredibly blurry photographs of the same page of a book. If you look at just one photo, you can't tell if a smudge on the page is a letter or just a coffee stain.
Right.
But if you overlay all 37 images on top of each other, the random smudges and stains fade away, and the true intended text perfectly reveals itself. Is that close?
That is a perfect way to visualize it, yeah. When you only sequence ancient DNA once or twice, you just don't know if a weird genetic letter is a true biological mutation or just, you know, chemical damage from the bone sitting in the dirt for 100 millennia.
So you need the repetition.
Exactly. By sequencing every letter an average of 37 times, it eliminates the guesswork. We can read this extinct human's genetic code with the exact same precision and confidence as a doctor reading the genetic test of a living patient in a hospital today.
Which is staggering. And reading that code told them exactly who this individual was. I know by looking at the coverage of the X and Y chromosomes, they proved D17 was male.
Yes.
But here's where I get a little lost on the methodology. To figure out exactly when he lived, they didn't just rely on dating the dirt he was buried in. They used genetic dating.
They did?
Yeah, I see the phrase transversion substitutions in the research. How do you date dirt using DNA?
Well, you don't date the dirt, you use the DNA itself as a molecular clock.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so transversion substitution is a very specific type of typo in the genetic code. It's where one type of chemical base swaps with a completely different type. And we know from studying living and ancient populations that these specific typos happen at a very slow, very predictable rate over time.
Like a ticking clock.
Exactly. By counting the number of these substitutions across D17's chromosomes and comparing them to a known baseline, the researchers can calculate how long his lineage had been evolving. So the molecular clock placed him at roughly 110,000 years old.
And that perfectly aligns with the physical dating of the cave dirt. So we have a male Neanderthal living in Siberia 110,000 years ago, mapped in high definition.
Right.
But a genome doesn't just tell you about one individual, right? It is a biological archive of an entire family tree.
Yeah, so the obvious next step for the research team was to compare D17 to the other ancient genomes we have. And the answer to who is he related to reveals a massive twist about what was actually happening in ancient Siberia.
Ooh, tell me.
So D17 belongs to a genetic group researchers call Eastern Neanderthals.
Yeah.
And he is very closely related to another famous individual found in the exact same cave, a female known as D5.
Okay, D5.
Yeah, and she lived about 10,000 years earlier, so 120,000 years ago.
I mean, that makes geographical sense. They lived in the same cave a few hundred generations apart. You'd expect them to be related.
Right. But there was another high-coverage Neanderthal genome from this region, a female known as Chag-8. She lived in a nearby cave in the exact same Altai Mountain region, roughly 30,000 years after D17, so about 80,000 years ago.
Okay, wait, I'm stuck on something. If Chag-8 lived in the exact same mountainous region just a few millennia later, shouldn't she be D17's direct descendant?
You would think so.
Yeah, I mean, you would assume the people living in a mountain range are just the great-great-grandchildren of the people who lived there before.
What's fascinating here is that the DNA definitively proves that is not what happened. When they overlaid D17's perfect genome with Chag-8's genome, they weren't closely related at all.
Wait, really?
Yeah, Chag-8 represents a completely different lineage. She belongs to a Western-derived population. Her ancestors actually came from Europe.
So the older Eastern Neanderthals, D17, and his ancestors were entirely replaced by this new group moving in from the West.
Completely replaced.
Did they mix it all?
Well, the researchers looked very closely for any signs of interbreeding. Because if the Western group moved in while the Eastern group was still there, you would naturally expect their descendants to have a mix of Eastern and Western Neanderthal DNA.
Right.
But the genetic data shows absolutely zero mixing between the two groups. This strongly implies that the Eastern group, D17's people, completely vanished from the Altai Mountains before the new Western group ever even arrived.
Wow. So if these Eastern Neanderthals were the first ones there and they just vanished before the new group showed up, what went wrong? Like, why did this Eastern group die out?
To understand their vulnerability, the researchers had to look deep into their social structure. And the DNA actually records how these people were interacting with each other through a concept called autozygosity.
Autozygosity. Break that down for me.
Sure. So in a genome, you inherit one copy of each chromosome from your mother and one from your father. Scientists look for homozygous chromosomal segments. These are long, unbroken tracts of DNA where the copy from the mother is exactly 100% identical to the copy from the father.
Okay, so they match perfectly.
Yes. And if an individual has a lot of these identical tracks, it means their parents were closely related, they shared a recent common ancestor.
Let me bring this back to the listener for a second. If you're listening to this, your genome is likely sitting at around 1% autozygosity, or maybe slightly higher, because your ancestors were part of massive moving networks.
Exactly.
Even early modern humans from around the same prehistoric era were sitting at between 1% and 6%. So what were the numbers for our guy, D17?
A staggering 24%.
24%?
Yes. A massive 24% of D17's genome is trapped in these homozygous tracts. The older female from the same case, D5, she was at 20%.
Wow.
So that 24% means D17's parents were extremely close kin. We are talking about recent ancestors who were likely first cousins or maybe double first cousins.
That is, I mean, D17's 24% is the genetic equivalent of a flashing red warning light that his species was cornered.
Yeah, and it wasn't just a one-off familial anomaly either. The researchers ran complex computer modeling on these identical tracks, simulating different ancient population sizes and migration rates.
Right.
And the simulation that perfectly matched D17's DNA proved that these Eastern Neanderthals lived in tiny, highly isolated groups of fewer than 50 individuals.
It's like living in an extremely remote, physically cut off mountain village where the only people you ever meet, the only people you can ever have children with, are your own extended family.
Exactly.
You compare that to the modern humans of the time, whose low homozygous percentages prove they were tapping into broader, interconnected trade and mating networks. They were constantly mixing with new groups.
Yeah, and living in a rigid, isolated group of under 50 people creates an incredibly fragile existence. You have no demographic safety net. If a severe winter hits and you lose your best hunters, or a new pathogen sweeps through your cave, or a local food source just dries up, a population of 40 people can cross the threshold of extinction in a single season.
Just gone.
Yeah. There is no neighboring tribe to ask for help, or to trade with, or to replenish your numbers. That extreme isolation is just a recipe for sudden disappearance.
Living in a group of 40 people doesn't just make you vulnerable to a bad winter, though. The paper points out that it fundamentally warped their evolutionary trajectory. It changed them genetically at lightning speed.
It did.
So how does living in a tiny group change how evolution works?
Well, the sheer speed of their genetic divergence is one of the most remarkable findings in this paper.
Yeah.
To measure this, the researchers used a statistical tool called the Fixation Index, or FST.
FST.
FST measures how much genetic variation is due to population structure.
Mm-hmm.
And FST of 0 means two populations are freely mixing and basically genetically identical. An FST of 1 means they're entirely different, sharing no genetic variation at all.
Got it.
So the researchers calculated the FST between the older Eastern Neanderthals, D17 and D5, and the Western Neanderthals from Europe. The FST was 0.30.
Okay, 0.30. Let's ground that number in reality, because here's where it gets really interesting. If you take the most genetically differentiated living human populations on Earth today, for example, the Mbuti people of Central Africa and the Papuan Highlanders of New Guinea, their FST is 0.27.
Right.
And those two modern human groups have been separated, evolving independently, for roughly 260,000 to 440,000 years.
Let that sink in.
Oh.
Modern human groups separated for up to 440,000 years reached an FST of 0.27, but the Eastern and Western Neanderthals reached an FST of 0.30 in just 115,000 years of separation.
Wow.
The Neanderthals drifted further apart genetically in a quarter of the time.
It's mind-blowing, but why? What is the actual mechanism driving that?
It is the mechanism of genetic drift operating in a highly restricted environment. Think of it like this. In a massive population, like an ocean of genetics, a random mutation has a very hard time becoming the dominant trait for the whole species. It just gets diluted.
Makes sense.
But in a tiny population of 40 people, the gene pool is a puddle. A rare random mutation can become the dominant trait for the entire group in just a few generations, simply by chance.
Because there's no dilution.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because they were living in these tiny, completely cut off pockets, they were evolving into highly distinct, separate regional groups much, much faster than modern humans do.
So because the gene pool is a puddle, not an ocean, genetic drift happens on fast forward.
Yeah, and this raises an important question about how we view our own history.
Hmm.
We often assume that the way we live, you know, in large, connected, expanding populations is just the default way to be a human.
Yeah.
But this data proves that the modern human strategy is a historical anomaly.
Right.
Neanderthals lived a completely different, highly fragmented existence. They weren't a single uniform species spread across Eurasia. They were islands of distinct genetics, constantly diverging, living incredibly localized lives.
Okay, but if they were so isolated that they were inbreeding and dying off, how did another species get involved? Because the cave they were found in is literally called Denisova Cave. It's famous for being the home of the Denisovans, which is another entirely distinct species of ancient human. Did D-17 and his tiny band of Eastern Neanderthals interact with the local Denisovans, or were they completely cut off from them too?
They actually did interact. The researchers used a complex computational tool called a hidden Markov model to scan the genomes of the older Eastern Neanderthals, D-17 and D-5.
A hidden Markov model. How does that work in the context of DNA?
Think of it as a statistical tool that looks for hidden patterns or states in a sequence based on probability. It's like reading a massive book written in English, and the algorithm is trained to spot the statistical probability of a French word suddenly appearing in the text.
Oh, that's a great way to think about it.
Yeah. So in this case, the algorithm scanned the Neanderthal genome looking for sequences of DNA that statistically matched the unique genetic signature of Denisovans. And they found long chromosomal segments that are a direct match.
No way.
Yes. This proves gene flow, or introgression. Huh. The ancestors of D17 definitely had children with Denisovans.
And we know it was relatively recent to their lifetime because those segments of Denisovan DNA were still quite long, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because as DNA is passed down generation after generation, those foreign segments get chopped up and shortened by a process called recombination.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that the segments in D17 were long means the interbreeding event wasn't millions of years in the past. It happened relatively recently in their evolutionary history.
But wait, if Denisovans were in the neighborhood the whole time, and we know from cave dirt DNA that Denisovans occupied that site off and on for hundreds of thousands of years, why did D17 and the early Neanderthals mix with them, but Shagate, the younger Neanderthal who lived in the same region 30,000 years later, totally ignored them?
Yeah.
Because the paper notes, Shagate shows virtually zero evidence of Denisovan mixing.
It is a brilliant paradox. You have early Neanderthals coming in and mixing with the locals. Then the early Neanderthals vanish. The late Neanderthals arrive, live in the exact same mountains, but their DNA shows no recent mixing with Denisovans at all.
So
the most likely answer is timing, the nature of ancient migration. Shagate's ancestors were likely very recent arrivals to the Altai region who simply didn't cross paths with the Denisovans.
They just missed each other.
Yeah. It shows that ancient human migration wasn't this constant, stable melting pot where everyone hung out together for millennia. It was episodic.
Right.
It was sudden waves of movement driven by climate shifts or chasing herds. A group of Neanderthals might push into a valley, live there for a few thousand years, encounter a small band of Denisovans, and then either die out or move on.
Wow.
And then 10,000 years later, a completely different group of Neanderthals sweeps into the exact same empty valley. They inhabit the same caves, but they're living in a completely different world.
So to summarize the central insight here, what does this all mean? When we take a step back from the Zoom S scans, the milligrams of bone powder, and the FST calculations, What is the grand narrative that D17's DNA reveals?
It completely shatters the idea that Neanderthals were a monolith. The history of Neanderthals is a story of profound fragmentation. There were diverse species, but they were broken into these tiny, isolated bands of fewer than 50 people.
Right.
This hyper-isolation led to massive genetic drift. They changed rapidly, developing unique localized traits, and they had unique localized interactions with other species like Denisovans. But that same isolation was their Achilles heel.
It left them so vulnerable.
Exactly. It meant that whole lineages like D17's Eastern Neanderthals could just be wiped out by a bad century of weather, only to be replaced thousands of years later by distant cousins who had no idea they were walking on the bones of their own kind.
Looking at D17's 110,000-year-old genome holds up an incredible mirror to our own species. We survived. They didn't. And this paper suggests that the secret to our survival wasn't necessarily bigger brains or sharper spears. It was our social strategy. It was our vast interconnected networks. We didn't let ourselves get trapped in genetic islands of 40 people. We reached out, we traded, we interbred, we built a safety net of humanity across the landscape.
Yeah, the Neanderthal extinction wasn't a single dramatic event. It was the slow flickering out of a thousand tiny isolated fires.
What does this mean for our own evolutionary future? If our early modern human ancestors had adopted the Neanderthal lifestyle, if we had chosen to remain in totally isolated, rigid mountain groups of just a few dozen people, never reaching out to the next valley, would we have eventually splintered into dozens of entirely different human species? Or would we have simply faded into extinction, just like the Eastern Neanderthals? It's something to chew on. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science bass by bass.
Signals in the choir.